From Utah Public Radio, this is Undisciplined. I'm Matthew LaPlante. A while back on this program, we dedicated an episode to the subject of sexual harassment training, about what works and what doesn't. And Debbie Doherty, who is a professor of communication at the University of Missouri, told us that much of the anti-harassment training that almost everyone in a large organization goes through simply doesn't work. And sometimes it even backfires. The unintended result is often a culture of fear, and men in particular often worry that good intentions or kind words or attempt at friendship will be taken out of context, and so they avoid and exclude women, which of course is exactly what this training is supposed to prevent. I kept thinking about Doherty's interview as I was reading a new book by Nilanjana Desgupta about implicit bias. For years, large organizations have been working to change culture through trainings intended to improve diversity, equity, and inclusion. But Desgupta says that a lot of this training isn't actually rooted in science. And in some cases, it can backfire. As Doherty told us a while back, none of her work suggests that sexual harassment doesn't happen. The research is really clear on that. The question is what to do about it. And Dasgupta's book makes it clear that the prejudiced cultural patterns that reinforce discrimination and inequity have been really well established by researchers in studies that go back decades. That might make it seem like huge efforts are needed to change these patterns. But Dasgupta says the scientific evidence suggests something different. As it turns out, she writes, organizations and their leaders can make big differences through relatively small changes, changes that might seem at first to amount to a simple change in the wallpaper. Dasgupta is a professor of psychology and the director of the Institute for Diversity Sciences at the University of Massachusetts Amherst. Her book is Change the Wallpaper, Transforming Cultural Patterns to Build More Just Communities. Nilanjana Dasgupta, welcome.
Thank you. It's great to be here, Matthew.
Nilanjana, as a climate scientist, I found that when I think about challenging the orthodoxy of beliefs about our future and the strategies we need to survive and thrive in it, I get really worried that I'm going to be adding fuel to the fire of climate denial. And when you wrote early in your book that billions of dollars have been spent on diversity, equity, and inclusion training, and that the research suggests we've gotten little bang for our buck in terms of actual behavioral change and cultural change, I felt this immediate connection. Did you worry when you wrote those words that people in power would use them to attack the notion that discrimination, disequity, and disclusion are actually a problem?
I actually did. I also thought that if we don't say what doesn't work, that's also a problem, because the things we are trying to do to try and solve it, if those alleged solutions don't work, we're sort of caught in a trap. We're trying to do something that doesn't work, and yet we have a problem that we're not solving, and we keep running in this cycle, in this loop, over and over again. So as a researcher, as a scientist, when you try something and it doesn't work, and you run that experiment a few times, and you come up with the same null hypothesis, then you try something different. And the result was this book.
This is your first book, right?
Yes. I'm in the world of writing articles. I don't write books. So this was actually really fun to write, to try and use science for social good.
I got to say, you say it was really fun to write. It was fun to read. And that came as a little bit of surprise, because while I believe this information is important, it doesn't on its face feel like it's going to be fun. It feels like it's going to be a little bit of a slog, and that I am going to feel like, as a white man, a very privileged white man, I'm going to feel guilty. I didn't feel that way. It was fun to read.
I don't think guilt makes change. I don't think exclusion of any group of people has any benefit. I think it's actually mixing and relationships and bringing people together, or calling in, to use another phrase that I really like, is actually where the change happens.
We do need to come to some kind of common understanding that the problem is a problem. And you spent several chapters giving example after example of implicit bias and citing study after study establishing that these anecdotes are not just anecdotes. These are reflections of real injustices that permeate our world. But you have also written that factual information isn't enough. And even when that information is shared with people with really genuinely good intentions, that's not enough because, as it turns out, attitudes and beliefs don't change behavior.
Exactly. And I think that is something we humans have a really hard time with, because coming from an individualistic society, we really put a great deal of agency on individuals. We think that if only we believe whatever we believe, we will act in line with our beliefs. Our behavior is influenced by all kinds of stuff. So the assumption that our beliefs will fall in line with our behaviors just doesn't hold. And then finally, even if we could get people to act in a certain way, then when you let us back into our organization, the organization has its own norms and customs. Those pressures of the situation would crush us. We would walk back into our organization and we will fall right back into the inertia of the system. So situational powers and just the ways things are done really don't allow individuals to shift organizational culture. You really need groups acting together to change systems, to change culture.
And this is sort of the secret sauce, because as you said, working from the bottom up like this, it's not very effective. But what you've written in this book is that institutional cultures can be changed. And it's work to do this. We don't want to say that this is very easy, but maybe not so much as a lot of people might assume. It amounts, as you say, to changing the wallpaper. And you've identified four kinds of wallpaper. And so I wanted to just touch on those briefly. Firstly, one kind of wallpaper is people in influential roles. Talk about that.
The people we see, so people in high places, think about what I think of as the portraits on the wall.
Oh, you give this great description in this book about being at college for the first time and walking down the hallway and seeing all these beautiful portraits of mainly rich white men.
Yeah, or rich white women, basically the donors in the college who get to have their portraits on the wall, the rich alums. So the people in high places, the people who are respected and valued, we want to be like them. The flip side is that the people who are missing, we understand that they are less valued and respected. If we see the same kinds of people in highly valued roles, and if we see the same kinds of roles that are always elevated, we implicitly understand that those kinds of identities and those kinds of roles is where the action is. And we all then gravitate toward the valued and respected roles. That's one kind of wallpaper. So the shorthand is representation.
How do we change that wallpaper? And I know this is complex. I mean, this is what the girth of the book is about. But as a starting place, where do we go?
I think one kind of way we change it is through networks. So if we are one of those people, try and tap people who are different from us to open the door for them, to give them access to roles like us. So if somebody is in a role where they are in an influential role, they might actively, proactively look for other people who wouldn't otherwise get an opportunity and give them internships in their organization so that they can get to see what it's like to work in an organization in whatever capacity, as a beginner, as a novice. That the people who are in these influential roles can act as, instead of being gatekeepers, they can act as gate openers. You know, in the book, I talk about more than 50% of jobs in the US and in other countries are really obtained not through formal ways of applying for jobs. They actually informally get referred to jobs and then they apply for jobs, or they have informal coffee chats. That's how most people get their jobs. Imagine if those kinds of informal coffee chats were had not between people who were of the same type, but between people who were of different types. That's how doors get open, and that's how representation becomes more diverse.
I do think this is a step that a lot of organizations are at least trying to do, changing hiring processes, diversifying the pipeline, taking new steps in hiring. But you write about a chicken and an egg problem related to this, related to bringing in someone who is not homogenous in the way that the organization already is.
If an organization is more homogenous, somebody who is different in whatever dimension might look at this organization and think, do I want to come in here and be the only one of a kind? I'll be totally out of place. And if they have a chance someplace else where they would feel more at home, they wouldn't want to be in a place where they would be the only kind. Or they would come in only to leave a few years later, which is actually the thing that happens most often. Most often, it's a revolving door. People stay for 3 to 5 years and then they leave because the place is not one where they feel at home or they feel stuck.
Let's talk a little bit about material culture. This is another kind of wallpaper that maybe is not being addressed so much and so intentionally right now.
I love this material culture type of wallpaper because I think that this is probably the one that is the most invisible. So material culture is all the physical stuff around us. It's the design of office spaces. Whose office is next to whom? Does a floor have a communal lounge? The basic finding is that when people who are in more prestigious jobs have offices that are segregated from people who are in more beginner jobs, they never get to see each other. But when people's offices are mixed up or intermixed, or when they have a communal lounge where they get to see each other at lunch, there is a lot more casual conversation and intermingling and a lot more humanizing that happens. So the physical design of buildings, of organizational spaces, really either integrate people or segregate people. This is as true of organizational spaces as it is of neighborhoods.
You give two pretty good examples of this in the book. One is Bon Appetit magazine, where the executives were, you know, four floors up from the people who were, you know, laboring in the test kitchens and doing the work that allowed that magazine to be produced. And then another is an example of this guy, David Cancel from Drift. Talk about what David was doing at Drift.
So David Cancel at the time was the CEO of a tech company startup, and he sat with his employees, shoulder to shoulder with his employees in the open floor plan. And as a result of it, his rank and file new employees got to know DC, as they called him, and got to know him and got to see him as a real human. He got to know them, and they felt that he really understood them and that he wasn't just their boss. This was very different from the Bon Appetit example, where all of the executives were the C-suite people who were on the same floor, completely separate from the people who were running the test kitchen and trying out the recipes, who were in these windowless kitchens on the lower floor. And those test kitchen food testers never got to see the people in the C-suite.
It could be so easy to sort of deride what David Cancel was trying to do there is sort of like cute or gimmicky. But here's a guy who's had five successful tech exits, right? I mean, this guy is a highly successful entrepreneur. He's not doing this because just because it's wallpaper per se. He's doing it because it works.
It works in the sense that it helps with the team glue. It helps with productivity. It helps with retention on all of the metrics that a startup company would care about. It helps. Yeah, it's not just about the gimmicks.
I love the fact that his last name is Cancel, because it's like this is a great kind of cancel culture, right?
I hadn't even thought about that. That's exactly right. It's the opposite of the cancel culture, right? That's exactly right.
Let's move on to symbolic culture. These are the stories we tell, the symbols we use. The word that kept coming to my mind as I was reading this chapter was branding. Talk about symbolic culture and how that's important to us.
Yeah, so symbolic culture are essentially stories. So stories provide explanations for why things are the way they are. So they provide interpretations for social reality. Tell us why something is fair or unfair, whether something is deserved or undeserved. So stories tell us whether we should accept inequality as normal and deserved, or whether we should reject it as abnormal and undeserved, and whether we should fight for something different. So my favorite sort of type of a story is one that, you know, I read as a kid, The Little Engine That Could. The little engine that helped a big train that had stalled, pulled it up the hill and worked really hard and climbed up the hill and didn't know if it could. And it finally it got to top of the hill. And what is the lesson of the story? The lesson of the story that kids learn is that if you work really, really, really hard, then you will succeed. That's the lesson of the story. What is the flip side? The flip side is that if you don't succeed, you mustn't have worked hard enough. So stories give us lessons. Some lessons are explicit. Hard work pays off. Some lessons are just left implicit. If you fail, you haven't worked hard enough. So that's what symbolic culture is. They are stories that provide explanations for why things are the way they are.
You write about how stories define the way that we see success. We tend to think of success as something that happens as either internal greatness or, you know, really hard work. Sort of like this masterfully played game of chess. But in reality, you say it's a lot more like the childhood game of chutes and ladders. And more than that, it's a game of chutes and ladders where not everybody gets to start at the same place. And some people get to spin the dial more than others. So how do we change the stories we tell about success? And then how does that in turn help change the culture?
Yeah, that's a great question. And I think the way we change it is to tell the story of success differently. So the way we tell stories of success currently is we tell it like Einstein's story. And we tell the story of Einstein as this brilliant person who was born a genius and everything was easy. And lo and behold, he won a Nobel Prize and changed, revolutionized physics. But as I tell his story in my book, if you probe deeper and you read Einstein's biography and you read his collection of letters, what you find is that his story is actually not like that. Einstein didn't do well in elementary and middle school. He didn't get into college the first time around. He had a really hard time getting a job after graduating from the Polytechnic Institute in Zurich. He had to pull connections, and a friend's dad got him a job at the patent office in Bern. And he struggled to balance a job and home life and finish his PhD. And he was supported by his parents. His wife was also a physicist. Her support sort of had faded into the background until much later. So his story was much more complex and full of struggles and quite a bit of failure. But we sort of airbrush his story into one that is linear and easy. I think we need to tell his real story. And I think we need to tell everybody's real story, that talent is developmental, that talent is circuitous. There's struggle, there's a lot of failure, there is sharpening of skills, that there is support from others, that there's a whole bunch of luck along the way. Sometimes things work out, sometimes things don't. And that's the whole complex basket of human endeavors. That's the story we need to tell.
Let's move on finally to behavioral norms. This is one more kind of wallpaper that you write can be changed from the top down to have a substantial impact on institutions.
I think of norms and expectations as sort of the unspoken roadmap that some people know and others don't as they navigate the maze of important social institutions that are the path to upward mobility. Those may be college and university, they may be your first job, they may be whatever. It's basically what is the etiquette, what are the unspoken rules of the game that are not written down, that you learn from parents, from peers, from siblings, from coaches, but that others are not privy to. And this is often really an issue of social class. It is really the people who are upper middle class and wealthy who know the rules of the game, and others who are working class, middle working class or poor, who don't know the rules of the game unless they are lucky enough to have coaches or mentors or teachers who along the way teach them. A way these social norms work is that they reduce the friction and allow people to take advantage of opportunities when they come along. And in other cases, those kind of not knowing the rules of the game makes other people hang back or creates more friction and sort of makes them struggle more. So the image that I have in my mind that I then sort of visualized in the book is that of a maze. Some people know how to get through the maze and other people get stuck in the maze.
You work for a large university. I assume your university has DEI training. When you sit in that, when you experience that, knowing what you know, studying what you study, what goes through your mind?
I've actually been talking to all of the university leaders who are sort of leading various kinds of diversity, equity, and inclusion initiatives on the faculty side, on the student side, and the provost and the chancellor about rethinking what we do. In fact, I've given now 3 presentations to various cabinet leaders, and I've given copies of the book to the chancellor and the provost, and I have a lunch coming up with my provost on exactly this. I think I want to, and the university is interested in using this as an opportunity to use our campus as an initial place to try out something different. I don't know what exactly we will do, but I think there is a lot of interest in trying something different.
That's Nilanjana Dasgupta. She's a professor of psychology and the director of the Institute for Diversity Sciences at the University of Massachusetts Amherst. Her new book is Change the Wallpaper, transforming cultural patterns to build more just communities. Nilanjana, thank you so much.
Thank you, Matthew. This was so fun. This was really fun. Thank you.
Undisciplined is a production of Utah Public Radio. And if you happen to live in Utah, you can listen to us on UPR every Thursday morning at 10:30. If you miss us, then you can listen to every episode of Undisciplined wherever you get your podcasts. Our program is supported by the College of Humanities and Social Sciences at Utah State University. And from listeners like you, you can support UPR's work at donate.nprstations.org/UPR. Our producer is Reagan Edelman. Our theme music is Little Idea by Benjamin Tissot. And I'm Matthew LaPlante. Thanks for listening. Now go have big ideas.